morning, everyone. Wasn't that an amazing session this morning? This is going to be quite a day, and we have another amazing session right now. You heard mention of the underwater report. We're going to have a brief presentation of that from Robert Frudenberg, who is Vice President for Energy and Environment at RPA, and then our panel will be making presentations. I'll introduce them after Bob's presentation, and to discuss this absolutely incredible piece of nature that is so close to us but so far away in terms of what we need to do. So, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeannie, and thanks all of you for being here today. We appreciate your time and attention to this. We're going to cover a number of things today to kind of set up this really great panel of folks who know the Meadowlands and know things really well. Clicker does not seem to work. Try the computer. Let's try this. Okay, thank you. All right, so today we're going to cover a few things in an effort to set up the panel here. One thing, as Jeannie mentioned, we're going to discuss a little bit of the work we did in our report underwater. One of the things that that report does is focus on the difference in how we plan and respond to storm surge versus sea level rise. We'll take a look at how sea level rise will be affecting the New York region. And then finally, we're going to dig into the Meadowlands to really start this conversation here, really focusing on the communities, the infrastructure, and the natural and contaminated land in that really special place. Okay, so in December, we released a report called Underwater. It's available on our website, and it takes a look at how sea level rise will be threatening the tri-state region in the coming years. A lot of the work and kind of research we've done will be presented today is covered in that report. One thing, as we mentioned, that it's we found is a real important distinction to make is the flooding that happens from storm surge versus the flooding that happens from sea level rise. If you take a look at this picture here, this is Manteloke, New Jersey, a Barrier Beach community along the Jersey Shore. You get the sense of what the flooding from storm surge does. You can imagine that this community had a pretty fair warning that Sandy was coming. This is a Sandy picture. The community was able to choose whether to evacuate or not. And, you know, the storm came, the storm surge rose, the wave action knocked homes away along with the flooding. Roads were washed out, and homes and businesses were washed away. And then began the long process of recovery. And hopefully building back in a stronger and more resilient way, though I think there are real questions of should we continue to be redeveloping in places like this. That's kind of the action and the reaction to storm surge flooding. You have word that something's coming. You can take action, move away, and come back and rebuild. Sea level rise flooding, on the other hand, is something that is a little longer in its timeline, a little more slow and persistent. But it's something that's going to happen, and it's going to stay with us at some point. This is Broad Channel New York in Queens, where they're seeing the early symptoms of sea level rise flooding, which is called nuisance flooding. So when there are particularly high tides during a month, this one happened to come after a nor'easter, so it's particularly high. But when you have a really high tide, it fills up the community, fills up the infrastructure, basements, storm drains, and it lingers around until that particularly high tide goes out. As sea level rise keeps getting more and more, eventually that water is not going to recede, and we're going to be living in communities that have this condition on the ground. So when we talk about the flooding from sea level rise, we want you to keep in mind that this is the image that we want people to have of the kind of flooding that happens and that doesn't go away like it does with storm surge. So, one of the biggest questions people always wonder is, when is sea level rise happening? Now, we all know this is based on models, and the models are the best that we have, and they're always improving. But according to the models that we have now, kind of the higher, medium to high projections show that we're likely to see 1 foot of sea level rise sometime by the mid-century, if not before. And if not before, is as soon as about 15, 20 years or so. 3 feet of sea level rise, it looks most likely by the end of this century, but if possible, before. So sometime after the 2050s, we could see sea level rise of 3 feet. And then 6 feet, which would, as we'll see, dramatically change the coastline, it's very likely by the next century, though, some of the studies that we're seeing, some of the more recent studies we're seeing that show more catastrophic flooding, and as we see these ice shelves melting and falling off, we could see that sooner. So what does 1 foot look like in our region? Probably a little hard to tell with the lighting here, but the blue here are places that are now land that would be flooded. 1 foot of sea level rise, which again we could see in as little as 20 years or so, would cover 60 square miles of the region, affecting the places where 19,000 of today's residents currently live and the place where 10,000 jobs are located. You'll notice in this it's largely a suburban phenomenon in this case. Our urban areas are a little more built up, a little more armored. So you see this is really affecting the South Shore and the Jersey Shore and kind of the Bay communities, Back Bay areas. By 3 feet, we about double the area that's covered, 133 square miles. 114,000 residents of today's residents live in places that would be permanently flooded by 3 feet of sea level rise and 62,000 jobs. Again, this is kind of a deeper pronouncement of the suburban flooding, and we start to see it in some urban areas, particularly along Staten Island and portions of the Rockaway Peninsula. By 6 feet, again, we have a dramatic new coastline, permanently flooded land up and down the entire coast of our region, 280 square miles, and now that we've hit the cities, 620,000 residents currently live in places that will be flooded, and 363,000 jobs. Now, one thing to note in each of these scenarios is that there's one place that really lights up, a few places that light up, but one that is of particular interest to us, which is the New Jersey Meadowlands. Now, the Meadowlands, if you zoom into it, is at particular risk of sea level rise flooding. It's low-lying, it's an estuary, it's a floodplain of a river, and we've done a good job of really manipulating it and developing into it over the years. As we'll see in the slides ahead, we have many communities in the Meadowlands. We have a lot of infrastructure, and we have a lot of contaminated sites that are at risk. So if we picture the Meadowlands with permanent flooding, it begins to raise some questions about what we need to do. So if we zoom in, and now we're turning the Meadowlands on its side, just so you're oriented here. If we look at populations, with 1 foot of sea level rise, around 1,900 people in the Meadowlands could be permanently flooded. With 3 feet, it goes to 18,000, a big leap. And then by 6 feet of sea level rise, we're talking about 36,000 people living in places that would be permanently flooded. Now, you can get a sense of where these concentrations are. The red means there's more density, more people. It's one dot is per person, so the hotter the dot, the more people. And you see places that are really affected include Little Ferry, areas around Secaucus, and Menaki are particularly hard hit. If we look at jobs, the Meadowlands has become a major employment center for our region. It is one of the key places for warehousing and distribution because of its access and proximity to New York City, as well as all the roads and railway lines that go through there. So many of these jobs that we see are in warehousing distribution, though there are a lot of office parks and other things like that too. We've really developed the Meadowlands as an employment center. So with 1 foot of sea level rise, we're talking about 8,500 jobs in places that could be permanently flooded, 54,000 by 3 feet of sea level rise, and with 6 feet of sea level rise, we're talking about 83,000 jobs in this region that would be permanently flooded with sea level rise. And you have to think, this is where we start to see the importance of the Meadowlands in kind of keeping the region moving. This is where our goods come and move through and where people work to kind of get them there. Related to that is the infrastructure, transportation infrastructure. If you're a New Jersey resident that works in New York City, you pass through the Meadowlands. If you are traveling between Boston and D.C. on Amtrak, you pass through the Meadowlands. If you're traveling on the New Jersey Turnpike, you know there it splits in the Meadowlands, and there are two areas where it comes right down at essentially sea level in the Meadowlands. And obviously, Teterboro Airport is smack in the middle of the Meadowlands in an area that would be inundated with sea level rise flooding. So the numbers here are sobering. You know, there's two lines in particular, three, you know, all the lines that run to Hoboken that pass through here are at particular risk. They're low-lying tracks. And we're talking, and a couple of the main line and Bergen line pass through the Meadowlands at low levels as well, and then the Pascack Valley line. So about 250,000 rides per day pass through the Meadowlands, and about 250,000 commuters pass through the Meadowlands per day, going back and forth. About 55,000 of them ride on those lines that would be at particular risk of flooding from sea level rise. And then, you know, I talked about the major roadways here, but there's a whole network of local roadways, and these are the things that connect the warehousing distribution to the main roads, really low-lying roads in the Meadowlands, and we're not thinking about the impacts of this today. Now, the Meadowlands has also been a place where we've put a lot of really important critical infrastructure, critical facilities. We have a power-generating capacity of over 3,000 megawatts. That's enough power in the Meadowlands at risk of permanent flooding to power up to 3 million homes. We have wastewater treatment plants, four of them. On average, they treat about 300 million gallons a day of wastewater. Critically important facilities that keep us clean and safe and keep us powered in the Meadowlands as well. And then there's all the fuel storage, petroleum production terminals. There's a number of those in the Meadowlands as well. And then finally, you know, we have natural land in the Meadowlands, and there's about 800 acres in protected conservation with the Meadowlands Trust, Conservation Trust. But we have a lot of really important species. There's a lot of designations the Meadowlands has. It's at this really important juncture of the New York Bight, so it's a major stopover for birds, and it's a nursery for fish and other creatures. At the same time, the area is riddled with contaminated sites. You can see the map here, how many contaminated sites are within the Meadowlands, and it's unknown at this point what the risk of sea level rise flooding would do with these sites. Would they release the contaminants into the water, affecting the water quality around them? And same goes for all of the landfills in the Meadowlands. We've done a good job of capping things from the top, but what about the idea of seeping up from the bottom? That's not something we've necessarily been thinking about. So I think that leaves us with a few questions that, if I were in the audience asking questions of the panel, I would ask. You know, one idea is we've seen the population centers, we've seen how many people are in places, but we're only going to have so much funding to be able to protect communities in the region. So we're going to have some tough questions to ask going ahead of where do we invest in protection? Which population centers do we protect? And how do you protect within an estuary system where it's not just putting up a wall? This is water that's moving all around in many different ways. And then we have to ask the other side of the question of where do we retreat from? And then you can ask where do we retreat to? We're going to have to face this question in the Meadowlands, and we're going to have to start facing it soon. The other is with all of that infrastructure, fixed, interconnected infrastructure, how do we adapt that? These are rail lines that are low-lying, roadways that are low-lying. How much money will that cost, and how do you begin the process of raising things like rail and freight rail? How do we ensure, while we're doing all this, healthy natural ecosystems? You know, a lot of people worked very hard to protect the Meadowlands with all those contaminated sites and all of the issues that we face there. How do we make sure that we're doing this in a way that keeps this area, all the progress we've made there, where we need to get it going to the future? And then probably the most important question of all is when do we start to do this? There are good projects going on in the Meadowlands. I'll call out Rebuild by Design, the efforts going there. But it's our thinking that that does not go far enough to protect against sea level rise. There are thoughts and there's motivation building for the idea of a regional surge barrier, something that needs to be studied. But that will not keep out sea level rise flooding. So we have to grapple with these tough questions, and we have to start now. As Tom said this morning, there is no future generation to tackle this really tough question, so it starts with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. As you can see, as Tom said, the regional plans in the past did not deal with climate change, but we have something that we really have to deal with. If you look at the Meadowlands, you might think of it as a canary in the mine. And it's just a few miles from here, and it has a wonderful distinguished history. I'd like to recommend this book if you want to know more about it by one of our speakers, Robert Saverio. It is the most romantic sort of place. It was once a forest, believe it or not. And now, what is it? It's 31 square miles that has 14 municipal jurisdictions within it. Imagine that. It's governed, was governed in a district that was called the Meadowlands Commission, started in 1969, which did a lot to deal with the landfill issues that I, as a child, can remember driving through there, and we would just go like this as you went down the highway because it was really awful. It was recently consolidated into the New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority, who's governing this. 285 species live in this area. And if you want to do something wonderful this spring, you can take a pontoon boat along the Hackensack River. You just go to the website, sign up, and I guess you can get on. At any rate, it's really well worth seeing. So we have some wonderful speakers here who are representing different kinds of stakeholders who are thinking about the kinds of questions that Bob just put forward to us. First of all, we do have Robert Saverio, the author of this book, give it another plug, who for three decades was with the New Jersey Meadowlands Commission, 9 years of which was spent as executive director. He will be followed by Stephen Diltz, who is the New Jersey office leader of HNTB, but also has spent a good number of his years in career in the public sector as commissioner of New Jersey DOT, as chair of the New Jersey Turnpike Authority, and of the New Jersey Transit Authority. And in fact, in one of our pre-conversations before this panel, Steve said something to the effect, well, we didn't really think too much about the environmental aspects of this transport system we built. So he's going to talk
about it. Debbie would agree.
Well, of course Debbie would agree, because Debbie is the baykeeper.
She was the one who was reminding me about that.
And he served as executive director of the baykeeper, but also as a member of the New Jersey State Planning Commission and chair of the New Jersey League of Conservation Voters, which I'm sure is also reminding you of these things. And lastly, Catherine Sievert Nordenson, who's Associate Professor of Landscape Architecture at City College and Principal of Catherine Sievert Studio. Her specialty is how to integrate landscape and infrastructure. She is the author of On the Water, Palisade Bay. I'm sorry I don't have that book to hold up. I would. At any rate, there's a lot of literature about this, but more important, we're going to hear the dialogue from our experts. So we'll start then with Robert.
Thank you. When Peter Stuyvesant sent me over in 1647 to find a flat area beyond the Palisades, we did find this open area of white cedar. And that white cedar went all the way from what is today the city of Hackensack all the way to what we know now as Port Newark and Port Elizabeth. The white cedar was not very good to build, but the Dutch, when they came over and saw this site, they said, you know, not a bad place maybe to do some growing. And in particular, let's start growing some salt hay, primarily because we can then feed our cattle. And as the Dutch have done in their own homeland, it was also decided, you know what? We need to build barriers and dry out the wetlands and create solid upland areas for the purposes of our growth of our farms and so forth and so on. So they decided that they were going to build and dry out. They were going to build berms and dry out as much wetlands as possible. The whole idea was to build the berms, take the water out of the wetlands behind them, and then turn around and find fill materials that can be backfilled into those sites. Well, didn't work very well. The muskrats would eat through the berms, opening and making the dikes, or the earthen dikes, fail. The cattle would then drown, and the salt marsh would be going away. 1930s was a benchmark year for the city of New York, which the city of New York used to dump all its garbage into the Atlantic Ocean. But it found a new place only minutes away from New York City in Lower Manhattan, and that was called the Meadowlands. And New York City garbage was viewed at the time as this is something that will help us build uplands that we could build on. Okay? It's a good thing. Trust me, it's a good thing. Even to the point during the Second World War, we in the Meadowlands had a historical position where the Blitz of London, the rubble from the Blitz of London, literally came into the Meadowlands for disposal. Okay? Penn Station, down the block here, we can show you on a scavenger hunt when you're looking for Jimmy Hoffa, you can see the columns of the old Penn Station in the Meadowlands. It was funny that this organization, RPA, decided in 1931 to create a report. And that report, a model industrial city rising on the Hackensack River. And that report called for the filling of 172 million cubic yards of soil, rock, concrete, and other materials, where it envisioned 30,000 developable acres in the Meadowlands with 500,000 residents and 200,000 jobs. When Governor Hughes signed the Meadowlands Act, he said he picked up that RPA report and he says, I want this. And the Meadowlands Commission legislation, the authorization, which was basically an urban renewal statute, which, by the way, you would never see that statute ever again, considering the power and authority given to the commission at that time. And Hughes was able to make the legislature understand and agree based on the fact that the Army Corps of Engineers, who have been then and now dying to do flood control projects in the Meadowlands, but we don't have the same timeline as the Army Corps to do things, turned around and was going to get a $300 million grant from the Army Corps toward its reclamation. Now, the interesting part and the mindset, so you get it, it's nature versus man and the impact that man has had on this 31-square-mile area, okay? In 1969, the new master plan that we lived with from 1969 to 2004 called for 70,000 housing units, 3 million square feet of commercial. Get this one, 20 million square feet of office, 90,000 square feet of warehouse and industrial, and we were going to throw in 10,000 hotel rooms. And with the idea, by the way, that, okay, it's okay to fill in wetlands and to drain them for this purpose. And you know what? Maybe we'll leave 2,000 acres of wetlands out of the entire amount still staying in place. Now, remember, 1969, before US EPA, before NJDEP, before NEPA, before a whole host of environmental regulations that would come on board. So here you have the Meadowlands with a powerful piece of legislation, with a new master plan that couldn't care less regarding the lowlands, couldn't care less about the wetlands, and to the point where the Meadowlands Commission statute never had in it how it was going to make its money. The thought process was, we're going to reclaim, and we're going to be the redevelopers of this property and flip the property for development. That is the mindset. That's the mindset and approach. In between, there was an element called a process, which I got to say to you, my older son, in 1986 through 2002, we went through a federal process called the Special Area Management Plan, SAMP. I was able to get my son his undergraduate and graduate degree when the EPA, Army Corps, NOAA, National Marine Fisheries, NJDEP, Meadowlands Commission, Fish and Wildlife Service, all in the same room working together for the purposes of designating a new master plan that would be in compliance with federal regulations and state regulations. Needless to say, that did not happen. After almost 16 years working on that project and an EIS and so forth and so on, it called for 875 acres of wetlands fill for the purposes of satisfying the economic elements of a new master plan. 2002 comes in after Debbie Mann sued us, I don't know how many times, and the riverkeeper Bill Sheehan sued us and beat the heck out of us because the Meadowlands philosophy was phragmites are no good. They're a weed. They serve no purpose to the environment. There wasn't any discussion about the potential of using phragmites areas for water retention. Not even a thought anywhere. Until 2002, we abandoned the SAMP process, and within probably a year and a half, we decided to save the remaining wetlands and preserve the wetland areas in the Meadowlands, that 8,200 some acres that we talk about, or 2,400 acres of wetlands, phragmites or not. So that, remember those numbers I gave you before, the 70,000 residential dropped to 3,700. The commercial went from 3 million to 6.5 million because we included that ugly thing right off of Route 3 it's had many names. The Mills Project and Xanadu and this one and that one. And then as the hearing officer on that project with NJDEP, we gave the approvals for that in 2003, 2004. So 13 years later, we're just seeing construction starting again. But this master plan and the environmental impacts included that for the first time because the Sports Authority, as we used to call it at the commission, is Monaco. It's the same size as Monaco in the middle of the Meadowlands District, and you can't touch them because they're special. They give out tickets, and so legislators get tickets and booths and all that other kind of stuff. So Monaco was included for the first time. And from 10,000 units of hotel rooms to 2,700. Now, we had the master plan. That master plan turns from development on anywhere you can find space to redevelopment. Redevelopment was basically that master plan. And we had to show property owners of wetlands that were paying taxes and their assessments by the way, of those wetlands was based on the old master plan, $300,000 an acre for wetlands, okay? Until we had one tax appeal, the Sisselman property in the middle of this district that turned around and said, we can't build because of Army Corps issues, so this land is worthless. So the property went from 300,000 assessed value down to 4,000. Almost bankrupted the East Rutherford borough. But the one thing that I could tell you is that redevelopment right now is working well, okay? But today, and I work for some of the municipalities in the Meadowlands District and some developers. The whole concept and approach of resiliency, flood control, is on top of everyone's mind. It's the time where in the old days, you used to look at the heights of buildings and you looked at the FAA approaches to Teterboro Airport. Now we're looking at FEMA maps. We're looking at the whole issue of the logistics issues and so forth. So the mindset now is there. The will to do it is a whole other question, and whether the people are going to step up on the federal and state government to address this issue.
Okay, thank you. Wonderful, wonderful background. We need to get an oral history as well as that book. Get the real story. Steve.
Jamie, thank you. And let me pick up right where Bob left off with this discussion. Read Bob's book and read the stories and the histories of this district. We humans have done what we practically wanted every step of the way since the Dutch settled in the 1600s, the 1700s. We've made canals. We've made the roads. We've made iconic roadways the rest of the country and the rest of the world has heard of. We've got rails, freight. We've got passengers. We have innovative techniques. Patterson Plank Road, which many of us know, those were a series of planks. And we have invented and innovated and had our way. A couple of brothers tried to drain the Meadowlands. It didn't work so well economically. But with some exceptions, we've generally, technically, done what we wanted to do. So I would submit today that our challenge is not so much the technical, though some of the questions that Rob asks are certainly challenging. But we are smart. In this room, we are smart. In our industries, we are smart. We have figured ways to deal with challenges before. We want to go to the moon. We went to the moon. We want to develop a computer. We've developed the world's digital age. But there's a book called Start With Why. Simon Sinek wrote it, Start With Why. Rob's questions really get to how. How do we do it? I don't think we have the why really built around a consensus yet. That's the political problem that I think we have. The scientific community generally is in agreement, and there seems to be consensus, but they're rallying tomorrow in over 400 sites because the scientists believe that the scientific method is at risk due to ideological concerns and emotions trumping science.
Steve,
I think.
Nice,
what's that?
Emotion trumping science.
Oh, yes. I didn't even realize I was maybe very full of puns. But that's where we are. That's our era right now. So, important that we get to at this panel some of the technical issues. If we've got water encroaching on freight and transit rails and highways and damaging our environment, these are very, very important. But I would remind us that we have not figured out the why. My friend reminded me this morning that the head and the muscle really only come together through the heart. And if we don't have the heart to do this, there is no way, as a former commissioner, I will assure you that we will not be able to spend the public money that would be necessary to raise the rails, to raise the roads, and make that kind of investment. because nobody would dare spend the first dollar. The headlines would be too damning. And by the way, for those of you taking the train this morning, and I know a number of us did, you see what we're dealing with right now, and you see what we've been dealing with right now. And those tunnels are crumbling and being eaten away. And we knew we needed to replace the tunnels before Sandy, and now we are even in more dire consequences. My point is the agencies are busy. The agencies are busy figuring out how to get you home this evening if you're the 12% of the New York workforce that comes in from New Jersey. Many of you take the trains. And I don't think we've got the bandwidth at the moment to deal with issues that may be 70 years away. So I think we've got some consensus building. I think we've got some things to think about. How do we make this, make the heart, appeal to the heart and make this a little less threatening? You know, if you're against it, it may be a threat. And there's fear and possibly some ignorance. How do we figure that out? How do we reach out? How do we make this case better? Because we can be as smart as we want to be and as technically excellent as we want to be. But if we're not persuasive and if we don't figure this out, we're going to talk about the consequences today.
Debbie.
All right,
thanks.
I think you have a case.
Well, I have to say it's been really interesting watching Bob's conversion from the sidelines over the years, and now we're fast friends. Also, you know, I want to provide a little bit of the current context of where we are in the Meadowlands, and you know, First State, like we understand, and Hackensack Riverkeeper understand the value of the mass transit. And the redevelopment that happens in the area, and that drives the economy in this region, and we get it, but it doesn't come at the expense of the environment. And I have to say a great example is we fought with the Meadowlands Mills project, that's their American dream. It was supposed to be built on 200 acres of wetlands originally. So you could imagine, like how worse that would have been for that project if it had gone through like that. And thankfully, it was built on some parking lot areas that had already been filled. So I'll just bring up, I'm sure many of you know the recently, and Bob can opine on this more than I can. They dissolved the New Jersey legislature, and the governor signed the New Jersey Meadowlands Commission, and they moved the responsibilities of that commission into the New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority, NJSEA. And so we're wondering, this is, you know, fairly recently, like, what are the implications for the planning in the Meadowlands for that? You know, the core professional staff is still intact, but you know, master plan reviews coming up, do they have the capacity to do that? And do they have the capacity and the expertise to look at planning and deal with flooding and climate change now that they're in the SEA? So that's a big open question right now for us, as well as, you know, for the last 7 years, 2 months, there's been a complete lack of statewide or regional climate change mitigation, planning, or adaptation in New Jersey. Just nothing. We've dissolved the Office of Climate Change and our state agency. And, you know, if we are looking at climate change, it might be coming in when you look at hazard mitigation by counties or local municipalities are doing it piece by piece. We think of Hoboken in particular, or facility by facility. The largest wastewater treatment plant in New Jersey is located in Newark, and they are just going to build a wall around their facility. You know, that's the plan. So, and, you know, the Army Corps has been kind of tinkering around in the tidal Passaic for a long time as well. And they finally scaled back what they were going to build, about 13 miles of wall on the lower Passaic River. Separately, you know, we want to talk a little bit about the Rebuild by Design project that was proposed in the Meadowlands, is ongoing. I'm not sure if folks are familiar with the original concept that won and is now being implemented by, it's moved over to the state agency from the, I guess, the design project. That had a wall right in the middle of the wetland, like bisecting a wetland. And, you know, so from the very beginning, it was something as advocates we just could not support. And it's been, I think, really challenging to walk that back for the team that's working on it now and do the implementation. As, you know, they talk about hard decisions, you know, like hard infrastructure, walls and bulkhead, and then they talk about soft infrastructure, which I would think about rain gardens and green infrastructure, but they're calling them levees and berms. I guess so, you know, that's challenging for us to think about when you have all these natural resources and all this green infrastructure already intact, that you're bisecting it, you're filling it, or doing all these things in the name of flood control. It just intuitively does not make sense. And, you know, we're very concerned. There's a lot of contaminated soils. There's a petition that's with the EPA to list the Hackensack River on the national priorities list for Superfund. And, you know, as the Rebuild by Design project is moving forward, it seems like it's kind of gotten into more of a piecemeal approach. And they're looking at drainage ditches and pipes, kind of how you move water more quickly out of the system or through the system. But then they also put up, you know, a different scenario that has rain gardens or bioswales. And as, you know, community members, when we go to the meetings, we're like, how serious is this? You know, are you, you know, because, you know, listening to our comments, or are you just, you know, kind of listening to our comments? There's no draft environmental impact statement yet for the Rebuild by Design project, so that's when we'll really understand what's happening. And also, they can't fund operation and maintenance, which is a huge deal. So we have to think about that when we're building flood structures. And I don't disagree, communities need protection, and so do the critical infrastructure that we have. But then what's the long-term maintenance and operation plan for that? So those are, you know, kind of setting up the concerns that we have around Rebuild by Design, and ultimately what will we be getting for the millions and millions of dollars that are going to be spent in the Meadowlands, and, you know, will it meet the community's expectations, our expectations, the agency's expectations, and that's what's really unclear, because it could be a huge opportunity, and it would be such a waste not to, to do something for this region.
Great. Thanks to all my colleagues here on the panel. I'm going to try and take a kind of broader systems approach to the region and frame this question about what to do, and really to start addressing Rob's question about what, how do we adopt and adapt infrastructure in the Meadowlands to face this ongoing challenge of the incremental sea level rise. So the two-prong approach I want to put out today is first thinking about the idea of connectivity and flow within a greater system, and second, to think not only of flood but also health. And I think those are two things that we can look at very with an interesting lens on the Meadowlands. So in regards to the idea of infrastructure and flow, a lot of the ecological restoration proposals for the Meadowlands are really addressing that question of how can one create more flow within the water systems. And I'd like to make an argument that we've been doing quite, you know, interestingly in the last few months with Rob Lane and others at RPA as you move towards the fourth regional plan, but to think about the idea of a corridor, which is about flow and which is about really what the RPA has been focused on for so many years in the lens of transportation. But we're making an argument that, in fact, there's another kind of corridor, which is the ecological corridor, which is not necessarily at odds with the flow of transportation. So thinking about how an infrastructure could adapt to do more than one thing, be an ecological corridor of flow as well as one that's for transportation and the movement of people and goods. I think the Meadowlands really offers a really incredible opportunity to address that and test that question. So it's not a piecemeal approach of small projects, but one that's much more holistic, that looks at the region and connectivity, as well as multi-performance, multi-scalar, multi-use infrastructure. My second point on the question of two really interesting insurance issues that are before our government really these days are flood insurance and health insurance. I think they haven't really been put side by side, but I think there's a lot of shared territory there. So we're always kind of thinking forward to 1 foot, 3 foot, 6 feet, 100 years. And just for a moment, I want to take us back in time 100 years to around 1902 and the period just preceding that, where there was really a question about what is a wetland and what is it doing. And it wasn't called a wetland there. It was called a marsh or a a swamp, or it was seen as a place of disease. And I think this really is in the public health realm. It was a period before which the germ theory had been proven. So people really believed scientifically that disease came from the ground. It was the miasma theory. So essentially there was an exhalation of diseased air that came from the ground. If you breathed it, you would get sick and possibly die. And I think that this is a really interesting, it's a false narrative, but it's a very interesting one about failing, you know, wrong and right at the same time. It's a fascinating period for me. So this idea that if you drain the wetlands, you would create healthy land, that's really where all this impetus begins. And the Dutch, certainly they were looking at places where they could grow crops and graze cattle. At the same time, there's a movement that says if we have basically disease being breathed from the earth, the land is unhealthy and we can't live there. So these places that were wet were drained. They were seen as dangerous and diseased places where nobody wanted to live. And so you put all the garbage there. You put all the industry there. You put all the junk. You throw away everything that's not important to you, even people who are not of a certain, that's the most valuable land. And that's where you put your most vulnerable populations and housing them. So we can see a very long history of that from that period of, you know, the miasmic period forward, and we're still living with that legacy. So what I'm starting to think about now is how can we now take an idea about, with a kind of greater sense of public health, to address these questions of flood control and infrastructure in one that's more applicable to the health of both populations, whether they're human or non-human, biotic populations, but how we can argue for an infrastructure which actually produces a healthy place. And I worry sometimes that the flood control actually starts to reproduce the miasmic conditions of the 19th century, in that it's creating stagnation and cutting the flow, which I'm arguing for in the first point about connectivity and flow. If you have stagnant water, yes, the miasmists were right, you actually have breeding ground for mosquitoes. They didn't understand that mosquitoes were actually carrying vectors of disease for yellow fever and for malaria. But in fact, now that we know that, in fact, the species and the ecology are so interconnected to infrastructure and the flow of systems and system thinking, water systems, that health is really tied into that. So as we see a rise of Zika, a rise of West Nile in our region, if we start to cordon off and create these poldered areas of flood-controlled zones, we're actually going to increase our risk of disease as water levels rise and create more stagnation. So if there's a way to think about flood and health in a way that's parallel, that can then tie into multi-use infrastructure flows and regional systems and thinking in terms of both ecological and regional corridors in this greater system that we're looking at, I think that's a kind of more productive way to move the conversation forward potentially.
Okay, thank you. Very interesting perspectives. I'd like to go back to Steve's question, the why question. I think this is a very essential question before we get on to these other questions. So let me go to the Bob and run down the panel, and you can either be a pro or a con on the why. Let's see if we can predict what he's going to say.
Global warming is a fake. No.
What's going to sell the politicians?
It's fake news. I had a deal with him, by the way, on the NCAP project in the Meadowlands. That was a real experience.
It's in the book.
It's in the next book.
It's in the book.
It's in the next book.
Yeah, the dirty parts, I waited till after I'm finished being a consultant. Then I could talk really about everybody that I really didn't like.
But stay on this. Why should we care?
Why
should we care about the Meadowlands, and what should we care about the Meadowlands? Why and what?
You have a situation right now where these municipalities, the assessed value of all the property in the Meadowlands is approximately $6.2 billion, which is a significant element to these municipalities. If you have a situation where we see climate change having the impact as has been related, you're taking off the book $6.2 billion of assessed value, number one. Number two, the infrastructure that we have is so interconnected with the rest of New Jersey and New York City. You have to understand that part of this new rail project, the Gateway project, its entry point into the Passaic is in the Meadowlands. And if you have a flood situation in the Meadowlands, as has been predicted, those new tunnels are gone. They're gone. Okay? So the why is that the interconnectivity of the Meadowlands is part, it may be in New Jersey, but it's part of the commerce of New York City. It's in part of the Meadowlands is a key distribution element to the New York metropolitan area where everyone buys a warehouse for the purposes of delivering into New York City from the Meadowlands. Logistics is a key element of the Meadowlands. What's happening now is Amazon just picked up 600,000 square foot warehouse right across from Teterboro Airport for the purposes of making sure that they get those packages out quick. FedEx is all over the Meadowlands right now. We have six intermodal operations. Intermodal, the trains are coming from the West Coast, coming through Chicago, coming into the Meadowlands, downloading their containers. Those containers get on trucks, and that distribution goes everywhere in New Jersey and New York. So the economy, our economies are so tied together that that is the why we need to do something, okay? Now, the wherewithal, and I think I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, we're going to go down the why. Then we're going to do the what. Okay, Steve?
Okay,
do you buy that? Do you buy the economic argument?
I do.
That's good.
And, you know, Ben Franklin observed that New Jersey's the keg tapped at both ends, right? What was he saying? That through he's been right through history, New York and Philadelphia and New Jersey go perfectly together. They always have. And if it's the kind of state that we who live in New Jersey choose to live in, it always will. The future of the state of New Jersey traverses through the Meadowlands. It always has. Every mode of transportation is found within that district. Since the Dutch, it always has been. So if I want to live there, and here's New Jersey on my cufflinks, I love New Jersey. you know, the future of our great Garden State is there in the heart of the Meadowlands. But I really like where Catherine is going in expanding that argument, because it is such an abstract argument. Transportation planners generally go out 30, 35 years. Talking about 70 or 80 years and talking about the kinds of investments over the longer term that we'll need in order to raise and move and make some of those policy decisions, so abstract. Your daily commute is real. Those questions are abstract. And where I like Catherine going and really bringing it back to the personal health and tying things that are today. You tied health insurance and flood insurance and the flow of water today with the movement of goods tomorrow. We've got to figure out a way to kind of expand this. I think that gets to my question of why. Why does it matter to me personally? And sure, I'm in the biz and it matters. But if you're just Joe Citizen or Jane Citizen, what else is at play here? We've got to expand that argument. And Catherine, I thought, did a very nice job this morning doing that.
Well, give us a little more detail on that. You as a transportation planner, what's going to resonate with you?
Well, I'm not a transportation planner, though we have some in the room.
Or you've been involved with
I work with them. They let me hang
planners.
With them,
okay.
And the
All
engineers
right. Excuse
do.
Me.
So, I come from a government background.
You're right.
So, and again, that's the point I was making earlier, that you've got to respect the bandwidth of government right now. And these challenges, again, it is not, the government is not looking 70 years in the future. But somebody should. Somebody needs to. And they should be working on building consensus and working as hard as they can. Here we're talking about 1 foot, 3 foot, 6 foot. But I know that there's a high, medium, and low risk to those numbers, and that's a big difference. When I was commissioner, I was frustrated because I'd be handed a report that would say, well, boss, you're going to have to move the roads up in the next 40 years. Again, there was not a device for me to say go. It was not just pressing a button and making it happen. There's a lot that has to happen to get to the how.
But you pointed out there are other options that people might think are more important, like the tunnels. Mm. And so what's the relationship between the Meadowlands and the tunnels? I mean, would that resonate with you as a public servant, that
sure.
Maybe there wouldn't be such flooding in the tunnels if the Meadowlands were more spongy? I mean, does that make...
Well, that's an environmental argument that I'd ask Debbie to speak to.
Well, I'm asking if you can speak as a public official.
You can't... you can't. You're only as good as your lowest common denominator, right? So if you've got water that's invaded the rail lines or the road network, for half a mile, and the tunnel's clear, and out where I live in West Jersey's fine, I can't get there.
This doesn't argue for you then.
A little bit, not really.
That's not
which
the one
part?
Though.
Which part?
The tunnel's safe. If the
tunnels always argue. I mean, that's
they're the portal.
They're critical. But we're going to invest a lot of money fixing those tunnels. But if the Meadowlands are broken, flood waters right, the regular water level rises,
right.
It doesn't matter.
Right.
Well, all of this investment, these tunnels are 109 years old. So therefore, what we're planning for now, and gosh, we're probably talking about 2025, 2030. Are going to be designed to last another 125 years. So if Rob's high level is right, 6 feet, 2,100, you've just cut off 35 years of the value of those tunnels, because what's the point if we don't do anything?
Are they making that argument now? Are they connecting these two things? They, the public decision makers, and the public?
No one's talking about 2,100 right now.
Where are you? Why aren't you doing that?
Well, that's why I'm not in public office anymore. They kicked me out 7 years and 2 months ago.
I mean, you wanted to shove that off as a... I'm attacking you, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you
okay.
wanted to shove that off as Debbie's problem. But it's not Debbie's problem.
Right.
It's the public sector's problem. So how do we get the public to know that?
Public sector has many problems right now.
Oh.
They do. Seriously. They do. Right, I'm not...
I'm going to turn this over to you.
I would say, yeah, why? I don't know. I don't need another mall. Just let it go, maybe, Let's talk about retreat and reversion back to the natural state of things. But I know that smacks right into reality. Our office for Baykeeper is on the Raritan Bayshore in Keyport, and heavily hit, during Hurricane Sandy, was Union Beach right next door. There's no buyouts happening in Union Beach. People want to stay right where they are, and they'll raise their house on cinder blocks for 14 feet to make that happen. And so there's a huge personal element to talking about that, and it's a really hard conversation, but it needs to happen, because you cannot sustain what we're happening with the Meadowlands without thinking about that as an option. And I was going to say, it's all, for me, the tunnels are personal, right? I'm on the Montclair-Bouton line. I was 40 minutes late coming in because of signal tracks from Amtrak. So I was like giving the evil eye to the CEO this morning on the plenary. But, that's not going to help. So I get it. And my neighbors get it, right? Because we're looking at Darius. Because it's so personal to us.
But Debbie, how are we going to sell this?
People in Keyport don't care. People in Keyport.
Well, how are you going to make them care? That's your job, right? You're an environmentalist.
It's all of our jobs. That's a great question. If there was a plan that we thought was like reasonable and strategic and well thought out, we're certainly going to advocate and rally behind that, and we'll call all our elected officials. But we don't see that now. So where, I can't get behind something that we can't get behind.
Well, it's going to be a regional plan, a large regional plan that will have a sector that will deal with this.
Oh, yes. Rob's going to do that, and we'll rally behind that for
sure.
But
how about some more public relations? How many minutes did you lose today? A big clock? Or, why not get behind some of this?
I think that's a terrific idea, and I'm sure we'll talk about that the next time I'm looking at Tri-State. The economic loss is huge, but I think it is a real struggle, because Northern New Jersey gets it, but Southern and Central New Jersey do not. It's not part of
the
thinking.
Problem.
And I know this because I crossed that barrier. When you cross over the Raritan River, you're in a different landscape and a different communities. And I think if maybe we think about climate change and sea level rise more holistically as a state, and then everyone understands that it's coming to my community as well, then we all should be working together to deal with it, because the same thing is going to happen on the Bayshore and on the Jersey Shore, and maybe if we connect those regional areas together, then they'll work together.
It seems very remote. I mean, maybe 100 years from now, it's going to be a problem. How are you going to make it personal?
Well, I can tell you. It was talked about a little bit earlier, but there is already increased flooding during tidal events, people know. They get it. They're like, I can't get to my house. I can't get here because of the tide, and it's different. Things are changing. Are they making the connection to sea level rise? I'm not sure, but that's also because I would argue our public elected officials are not helping them make that connection. And there's no leaders right now that we have in New Jersey talking about that.
Well, don't you have a gubernatorial election coming up?
Yes, so that's why I spent all my personal time as chair of the New Jersey League of Conservation Voters, which is the can endorse. I can't do that as Baykeeper, but it was so critical to us that we were just losing in our legislature, and this is Democrats and Republicans, that we're spending time to do endorsements and embed staff, and we have a PAC, and you're absolutely right, and for the first time in a long time, the environment has kind of cracked the top five as an important government gubernatorial platform.
So. How about alliances with people like Steve?
Yes.
I'm setting you up as polar opposites.
Well, no, that's fine. I think so because I don't want to be brought in very late to the game, right? We don't want to be the people saying, this is outrageous. And Steve's like, oh, yeah, well, we just spent 2 years designing this, so I'm not sure.
But you're talking about civil society activity, too.
She's been playing like 10 years ago right now.
Right.
Civil society. Something about the energy master plan.
Yes.
But it seems like maybe you need multi-stakeholder civil society. You need to be reaching out to get the other stakeholders who have maybe different interests than you around this topic so that you can get to the people's. I'm worried about the heart and the mind that Steve told us about.
I think you're right, and I think the nonprofits right now sector are in the same boat as the public agencies. We're kind of working day to day, especially in the environmental sector. It's been crisis to crisis. We're so reactive right now because of state policies and regulations that have come down, and now we're seeing it on the federal level, and this is unique to, again, the environmental and the conservation nonprofits, that it's really challenging for us to take the time to organize ourselves and come up with a comprehensive strategy and then use all our networks to mobilize folks like you're talking about.
I think you need a green pussy hat.
I'll get my mother-in-law on that. She needed my last one. So, yeah.
All right. I'll stop attacking you both. Catherine, next. Let's hear some practical solutions to the why. The why.
The question on the why. I mean, I think what's very practical here, what could be made into an argument of why it's important, is the scale of this thing. And I think, again, I was fascinated, Rob, by that slide that you had with the contaminated lands that are in the floodplain. And I think, again, if one's able to make it personal by making it a question of health, like this is actually a dangerous, unhealthy place to live, and you might die. Not about flood, but about actually the environment is poisonous. We're back to miasma. The land is breathing.
Who's going to produce the evidence?
Well, we've made this landscape. I think that there's no such thing as a return to nature or a natural system. We're going to have to actually accept that we have to manage this landscape and most landscapes on our planet really carefully and ethically. And so I think that the why is really an ethical question, which can be a hard sell. But I think if one looks at a question that, you know, it's not only ethical, it's personal, and it affects everyone and their children. And I think that there's something to be said about we can make a healthier place of New Jersey, the Garden State, that's at a scale that's incredibly powerful.
Okay, so we believe that. Yeah. No problem.
Okay.
All right? But you're a university professor.
Right.
At your fingertips are all these researchers, right?
Absolutely.
Why aren't you getting them out there to prove and give you evidence for this?
That's a
argument?
Great suggestion. And I think, you know, the charge of the university really is to create new knowledge, right?
Of course.
And so I think that to go out and to really start thinking about how can one create a new argument for...
prove the argument.
Prove the argument. I think the argument's pretty clear. Yeah, it's not safe to be there. And it's not ethical to have people working and living in that region, but we need it. It's all about transportation and flow. It's critical to the joining of these two other states. And so I think that there's a real... There's a necessity, there's an urgency, and the why is definitely, there's no question.
Don't you have a huge transportation center there?
There's a transportation question, incredible water people at our disposal as
well. Well, water, transportation, landscape architecture, there you are.
And we just started a medical school.
Why not go to the NSF and get a big grant about the Meadowlands?
I'm in. I'm going to go home and write my grant.
Well, you've got to get a team. Steve will help you.
Can I ask you a question? I mean, is science enough, though, right?
No.
Wait, because there's science, you know, but I could present all the science I want to the Pruitt,
But is it specific to the Meadowlands?
He doesn't care.
Is it specific to the Meadowlands?
Well, I would ask for the decision makers. Is that what they're making decisions on?
Of course they're not. But if you get people excited about it, go on.
Let's deal with the practical politics of things. There's no romance without finance. Okay? And so you could have as many studies as you want. But the state of New Jersey is bankrupt as it stands today. So if there's any expectations of trying to do any infrastructure improvements today, it's not going to happen.
But, Bob, wait a minute. We just heard this morning Rit Agarwala saying we've got to reinvent our agencies. Oh. Maybe New Jersey's not capable of doing this. Maybe they've got to talk to New York. Ha-ha. I mean,
no.
We've got to get out of the box here.
No, but let me tell you where you can start. In the Meadowlands, as Debbie said, there is supposed to be a reauthorization of the master plan. Okay, number one. Number two, the land use regulations are very, very old.
Right, 2003.
2003, but trust me, a lot of it has been copied from the 1970s. So when we're dealing with approaches of sea level rise, how do we, if we have to build, how do we build to take that into consideration? Do we have to start putting buildings on platforms? Do we go higher than 14 feet? There's a whole host of things that I think the Meadowlands Commission, or whatever they're called today, can do. Now, even back to Debbie's point, with this consolidation, there is not enough staff there. There is not enough engineering or anything else since the consolidation to even address an issue of a master plan or changes to the zoning.
Well, I think all of you have made this terrific case for the Meadowlands, and the Regional Plan Association is going to come up with the fourth regional plan. Regional Plan Association really was active in getting the Pinelands passed and so forth. Maybe you need to talk more about a multi-governmental, multi-stakeholder effort in the Meadowlands if it's this important that we've heard. But I bet we've got questions from the – you want to say something?
Oh, I do, because it's true. When New Jersey has decided to make a priority – and usually it comes down to key leadership, by the way,
sure.
Right? The Highlands, the Pinelands, and other choices have been made, even the Meadowlands District itself, from political leadership. So yeah, let's not remove that mindset to it. It does take that courageous leader or group of leaders to will something over a lot of objections. And we're still capable of that.
Of course. But we do have those 14 municipalities with there. At any rate, I bet there are questions from the audience. I've been hectoring these people too long. Questions? Yes. Please identify yourself.
I'm Andres Hernandez. I'm with Lloyd. As we talk about how interconnected all these issues are, back to your point of financing, where do you guys see as the funding sources for fixing this problem?
From the Meadowlands, we actually did a lot of flood control work, but when my successor came on, it was decided that we're not doing that because it's not in the core mission, okay? We actually commissioned a study about creating a stormwater utility that just deals with not only the flood control aspects, climate change, sea rise, but also the biggest element that I know in the Meadowlands, which is a big issue, is maintenance of what you have. We are right now with the existing infrastructure is like $35, $40 million to fix alone, just to fix what you have. So we have a transportation impact fee. I don't see a problem as that utility authority, which was Rucker suggested, of creating an impact fee based on any development paying into a fund for the purposes of protecting their property from sea level rise or flood control. I think it has to be tied to something that's financial.
Yes?
We are all talking about the future right now. And so how are we going to mitigate and save ourselves after like 100 years or something? But so what can we start doing right now that can affect everything that we are thinking about 70 years in forward?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. How are you going to eat the big sub tomorrow for lunch, right? You're going to eat it one bite at a time. So my kind of worldview of politics, having served in government, is it's a maturity process, right? You watch your child mature, you watch you mature, right? And our systems really operate like that. Sandy taught us a very, very valuable lesson in this state, a wake-up call, perhaps late, but we have matured from that. We've learned about adaptation. We've learned about mitigation. We've begun some important strategies towards resiliency. These are words that I didn't speak when I was in public service. They really weren't spoken too much when I was in public service 10 years ago. So we've learned. We've matured. It's a first step to what your very question is. And I think ultimately I think that gets to that helps the why come around. Because it will take time. It'll take tomorrow and the scientists and a room full of good-willed people here and a lot of conversations like this and a lot of good ideas how to expand it and how does my neighbor feel like this is important to her. And those kinds of energies, what we do today. And I'm an optimist. Mike Bloomberg said that we'll figure this out closer to home and more private market-based and various solutions, and I do. I think that's where a lot of the financing will come from, more private sector as we move forward. That's an extraordinarily optimistic question you just asked, because what can we do today?
There's
lots of what we can do today that doesn't just snap of the fingers solve it tomorrow, but we'll get there.
I want to hear everyone answer this question. Here, along the panel, I mean.
I would say you have to elect the right people, and that can start today, right? From the local to the county to the state level, it's critical because that's where you're going to really make the change. So find the greenest and person and who talks about this, and if they're not talking about it, ask them. And you can, like I said, you can do things at your local level, and once that starts, I mean, that's kind of after this last election, we were sitting around our local environmental committee, and people were crying. But I was like, that's okay. We're going to do something right here in our town, and we're going to make a difference. We're trying to get solar. And they were like, yeah. So, it can, to me, like that's immediately everyone can do that, and that will make a big, big difference.
I would say it's important to think about engagement of the public in the place. It's very abstract. I think most people haven't been in the Meadowlands. We've all been through the Meadowlands.
Let's ask how many have. How many have been in
off
the Meadowlands?
Not on a train.
In, not through,
ooh,
but in.
Okay, that's good. Okay, so maybe I'm wrong, at least in this room. But I think that if one were to actually be engaged in a way that there's a kind of a feeling of stewardship that comes out of that relationship with the place. I mean, speaking from some experience I've had at Jamaica Bay, I've gone out in a boat at low tide, pulled up on a marsh island and planted Spartina alterniflora 24 inches on center with 500 other people. And it's a life, I brought my kid. It's a life-changing experience because you realize, wow, I just planted a rhizome and it's going to go in all directions. And you feel like you're a little piece of something much, much bigger than yourself. And I think that's a good way of thinking about stewardship and education and both ecological and environmental thinking. I think that when people feel connected to a place, I mean, not only is it good exercise to plant marsh grass and think of me, go out in a boat and get fresh air. It's also, it ties you to that place, and you feel when you fly over it from JFK or from Newark and you see the Meadowlands, or you sail through on your boat, on your train if it's going quickly, and you look at those, the waving of the beautiful Phragmites in the wind and the birds, the herons kind of taking, having habitat space within that area, you feel more connected. And I think that's pretty important to just start to engage a public in a way that they care about the place. And when people are passionate, this is the heart question, when they're passionate, they'll definitely want to think about, well, I don't want this place to go away because in all of its kind of tawdriness, it's beautiful.
So multiple imaginative campaigns. Bob?
No, there's no question that, look, it's got to start off, I think Steve is right. It's got to be incremental. But the campaigns, there's several levels of a campaign. And that is a grassroots campaign to bring people to the Hackensack, as was suggested. I've got more comments. I can't believe I live 2 miles from this place. But at the state level and at the federal level, it's a question of aligning the stars politically. So it's unfortunate that when New Jersey goes Democratic, the president is Republican. There's no, there's no synergy at all. It's just like you're out here. But you have today in politics, you have to read everything, see everything, understand it more than ever before, because as far as I'm concerned, there's a serious threat to democracy, to be honest with you. I'm 64 years old, so I've seen a lot, but the point of the matter is you have to do your homework. And I think some of this election was people not doing their homework and being impulsive. But you have, so there's various levels of a campaign by grassroots, then a little bit more sophisticated as you move up for the purposes of getting the federal government. I would love, for instance, for the federal government, as Trump had said, about infrastructure, $1 trillion. Now, what will that mean? I don't know. Is it going to include the tunnel? I don't know. Is it going to develop better infrastructure to control water and how it comes in and how it gets out? I don't know. But the concept is a great one. Now, whether you get it through the House and the Senate in the form that we think is good, then it's up to us to get back out to our representatives and say, if you're going to build this over here for a constituent as part of that money, don't.
All right, so we're getting some ideas here. You've got to be smart about this. Yeah. You've got to have multi-stakeholder support. You need some evidence. It's got to be multi-pronged campaign. It's got to be steady, and it's got to be long-term. It's not going to happen tomorrow. One last question. Okay, there we go.
If all the money were in place and all the designs were in place, who's in position to make the decision of what happens and where?
Who is or who should be?
Who should? Well.
In the Meadowlands is just one of a few areas in New Jersey where the Army Corps of Engineers has control and permitting action within the Meadowlands. So if you do anything here, not only you're dealing with NJDEP and dealing with those issues, but you're dealing with the Army Corps. And if you're dealing with the Army Corps, EPA can veto. And you have the resource agencies that can ask to have the issue elevated to DC. So that's basically the infrastructure. DEP has its requirements under the Coastal Zone Management Act, but you have the ultimate decision makers is on a federal level.
And your question is a good one, because I would submit that assume you'll have the technical know-how, assume you'll have the finances. So to your very question, it's everything else that really is the critical difference whether we're going to get there or not. You asked the right question.
Now, see, I prefer to see the power of the Army Corps delegated, like everything else in New Jersey, to NJDEP, because at least you're dealing with one entity for everything. If not, you're going to see the Army Corps doing a cost-benefit analysis of the proposed improvement, and then they're going to go to a NEPA EIS process. So, you're adding on maybe 5 more years.
But, you know, I just want to push back a little bit. We always blame NEPA and the EIS process for the delays. And, you know, I think that's a bit of a red herring. So, you know, I know that's not what you were saying, but, like, it's important to do the impacts cumulative on vulnerable communities. And that can it be done in a shorter amount of time? Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, when I think about the tunnel, that, you know, people are like, oh, it's because of the EIS and the NEPA. That's because of financing. Like, so often these projects are delayed because of financing. I think about the Mills project again. So I just want to, like, say, let's be, you know, let's not, like, go completely the other way on that.
I just got word from the powers that be, if there's one more question in the audience, we can respond to it. But maybe we've exhausted your curiosity. Yes. Now we've got three questions. All right.
Jonathan Simpkins, I'm with American Express. How are you guys looking at other states? Because this is a global issue.
Yeah.
Now, are you looking at the places like the Netherlands or Florida, kind of getting best practices as they see experiences before?
I can maybe jump in on that one. I've been paying a lot of attention to the Delta region, obviously, and the Mississippi River Delta. And there's incredible work that's been done both pre- and post-Katrina that's influenced our own work in this region. And I think the conditions are even worse, and so it's a good model. But there's a lot of rather innovative things that are going on. So I think you're right. You have to look around. I think, you know, the Dutch offer a kind of two-prong approach, one which is very much keep the water out. But there's the revisionist camp that's really looking at ways to work with water, you know, room for the river. So there's examples from other countries, but again, they're a very different situation than ours here. And so I think these always have to be tempered with the kind of local condition and local knowledge of a place, because geology is so unique in every location.
I think that's a great point. I think one of the stumbling blocks for the Rebuild by Design project, specifically in the Meadowlands, was it was not folks who knew the area making, you know, choices. And then when they did come in, you know, they didn't really engage the Meadowlands Commission staff and use their expertise and resources to really understand the history and the, like, dynamics in the Meadowlands. And I think it's been really challenging for that project team to overcome that. So that's a great point.
You have a situation where we created this Meadowlands Environmental Research Institute way back when for the purposes of taking science and matching it up to policy early on, dealing with all these issues. And we have an early warning flood system as a result of Mary and a whole host of things.
Great maps.
Yeah. And so, and by the way, they're all online if you ever want to use, you're involved with Meadowlands issues. But the point of the matter is that that was a great point. You take it, you synthesize it, and you see if there's anything that I can use here, taking into consideration my environment of people, places, and things, and can I plop it down. I knew we were in trouble when the first group from the Dutch that came in with Rebuild by Design, when I asked the question, do you have to do an EIS, and will you have to go to the Corps? And they said to me, no, it's all taken care of in D.C. Okay. I knew we were in trouble.
And then Bob just sat and watched it go down.
Well, I think this has been a wonderful panel. Let's thank our panelists. And I hope we've given lots of fuel to RPA and the 4th Regional Plan. Lots of ideas, lots of energy. Let's get going.
Yeah, I took a lot of notes.
Thank you.